Okay, we've come to 2 Chronicles chapter 17, and I'd like for you to turn there in your Bibles. The chronicler spends three chapters on Asa, who is overall evaluated as a good king, although at the end of his life showed some, at least laxness with regard to seeking God. And the next king, his son Jehoshaphat, is covered in four chapters and commended in even stronger terms than Asa, although it doesn't get the highest level of commendation that the chronicler gives. He still is commended as a good king. But again, as with Asa, his father, there are times in which he is unfaithful, especially in his alliances with the northern kingdom. That won't come up so much today, but that's the kind of a general summary of Jehoshaphat's life. He's a faithful king who walked in the ways of David, his father, and yet was unwise, at least, in seeking alliances with the northern kingdom. So I'd like to read 2 Chronicles chapter 17. Then Jehoshaphat, his son, reigned in his place, that is, in place of Asa, and strengthened himself against Israel. And he placed troops in all the fortified cities of Judah, and set garrisons in the land of Judah, and in the cities of Ephraim, which Asa his father had taken. Now the Lord was with Jehoshaphat, because he walked in the former ways of his father David. He did not seek the Baals, but sought the God of his father, and walked in his commandments, and not according to the acts of Israel. Therefore the Lord established the kingdom in his hand, and all Judah gave presents to Jehoshaphat. And he had riches and honor in abundance, and his heart took delight in the ways of the Lord. Moreover, he removed the high places and wooden images from Judah. Also in the third year of his reign, he sent his leaders, Ben-Hail, Obadiah, Zechariah, Nethanel, and Micaiah, to teach in the cities of Judah. And with them he sent Levites, Shemaiah, Nethaniah, Zebadiah, Asahel, Shemaramoth, Jehonathan, Adonijah, Tobijah, and Tobadonijah, the Levites, and with them Elishama and Jehoram, the priests. So they taught in Judah, and had the book of the law of the Lord with them. And they went throughout all the cities of Judah and taught the people. And the fear of the Lord fell on all the kingdoms of the lands that were around Judah, so that they did not make war against Jehoshaphat. Also some of the Philistines brought Jehoshaphat presents and silver as tribute. And the Arabians brought him flocks, 7,700 rams and 7,700 male goats. So Jehoshaphat became increasingly powerful, and he built fortresses and storage cities in Judah. He had much property in the cities of Judah. And the men of war, mighty men of valor, were in Jerusalem. These are their numbers according to their fathers' houses. Of Judah, the captains of thousands, Adna the captain, and with him 300,000 mighty men of valor. And next to him was Jehohanan the captain, and with him 280,000. Next to him was Amasiah the son of Zichri, who willingly offered himself to the Lord, and with him 200,000 mighty men of valor. Of Benjamin, Eliada, a mighty man of valor, and with him 200,000 men armed with bow and shield. And next to him was Jehozabad, and with him 180,000 prepared for war. These served the king, besides those the king put in the fortified cities throughout all Judah. Now that's the chapter I'd like to talk about in Chronicles, the first chapter about Jehoshaphat. As I said at the beginning, there's a lot that's said about him in a favorable way. The emphasis is really twofold. First of all, or threefold, I should say. There are three main points in the chapter. The first is the fact that he sought the Lord with a whole heart. As it says in verse 6, he took delight, his heart took delight in the ways of the Lord. And you might say that's the main and the key point in the chapter. And that's worked out in a couple of different ways. One way is in the military reforms that he brought about, or the military strengthening. I guess we wouldn't call them reforms exactly. But there's an emphasis, you probably noticed, both at the beginning and at the end of the chapter on the military aspect, strengthening city, setting up troops in various places. And that, of course, from the point of view of the chronicler and the history, is a blessing. Okay? They were not living in a peaceful time. They didn't have a lot of friendly people around them, although the chapter shows a further blessing in the sense that even the surrounding nations were either terrified or sending tribute to him, or both. So that's one aspect of the way in which the delight in the Lord worked out, was in his care for the defense of the nation. And the other way, and the way I want to focus on for quite a bit today, is this teaching ministry which he encouraged. And we made some comments at the start about all these verses up here. Well, those are all connected with the teaching ministry. And no, I don't expect to look at all of them, don't worry. But that is another aspect which is important here, and comes up again at the end in chapter 19. So it's not the end, but later on in the description of Jehoshaphat's reign is an emphasis again on this teaching ministry which he encouraged. So that's just kind of a summary of the chapter. I'd like to make a few comments on the part up to the teaching ministry, and then dwell on that a bit. Were there any comments or questions so far? We're all quiet this morning. Okay. So first, note the commendation given to Jehoshaphat in verses 3, 4, and 5, and 6. The Lord was with him, in verse 3 it says, and the reason is that he walked in the former ways of his father David. He did not seek the Baals, but sought the God of his father and walked in his commandments, and not according to the acts of Israel. Now the Baals, sometimes called the Baalim, is a plural word for the gods of the Canaanite religion, and beyond the Canaanite area, the area of Canaan. And it says, instead of seeking them, he sought, he walked in the ways of his father David. So that, you may not catch it, but that's a very high commendation for the chronicler to say. He didn't say that about Asa. He didn't compare him with David in a favorable way. The writer of Kings is more often includes that comparison. But the point here is really a contrast between seeking after God, walking in the ways of David, and taking delight, as it says in verse 6, in the ways of the Lord. There's a contrast between that and seeking after the gods of the nations around them, and the gods that were in the nation or in that land before they conquered it. But I'd like to point out again that this is Jehoshaphat brings about reforms. He does a lot of good things, but it's not just external action. The chronicler isn't just interested in what we do. He's interested in our heart attitude, because God is interested in our heart attitude. And so, as I tried to stress many weeks ago at the beginning when we talked about worship, although the chronicler emphasizes right action again and again, he did this, he thought about these reforms, he set this up and so forth, almost unfailingly he emphasizes along with that the heart attitude. And the words are very strong there in verse 6. His heart took delight in the ways of the Lord. So it was an action which was motivated by a true love of God. And there's a temptation, I think, to try to separate those two. It's impossible to separate the two, right? True obedience to God is true obedience that springs from a heart which knows the love and mercy of God and takes delight in Him. On the other hand, true delight in the love of God and in His mercy doesn't leave you unchanged, right? You don't take delight in the ways of the Lord and then you go seek the Baals. This doesn't fly, right? And so, that what was in his heart showed in the way he ruled. And that's a simple lesson, but I think if it were easy to learn, that he wouldn't emphasize it again and again. We need to hear again and again that those aspects can't be separated. The description of the Baals in verse 3, and then walking not according to the acts of Israel in verse 4, are in some sense parallel. What was going on in Israel, the northern kingdom at this time, was to seek after the Baals. And so I thought I'd point out at least that one cross-reference. So keep your finger here and turn to 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 29. Remember, the writer of Kings traces not only the southern kingdom to which the promises of David were given, but also the northern kingdom, and weaves those two accounts together into one account. In fact, the two accounts do come together under the reign of Jehoshaphat. It's in the next chapter of Chronicles. But in 1 Kings 16 and verse 29, it says, "In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, the son of Omri, became king over Israel. And Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel and Samaria 22 years. Now Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord, more than all who were before him. And it came to pass, as though it had been a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that he took his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. And he went and served Baal and worshipped him. Then he set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal, which he had built in Samaria. And Ahab made a wooden image. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him." And there's a description, interesting description there about the attempt to reestablish Jericho in the last verse. But you see, that's the contrast that's going on in Chronicles, right? He didn't seek after the Baals. Well, he had a role model, if you will, for seeking after Baals in the person of Ahab, who allied himself with this king, whose name is Ethbaal. So I mean, it gives you some idea of what the king's orientation was. The daughter, of course, Jezebel, is an infamous person in the Bible, and it's that connection will come up in chapter 19. Is amazingly, Jehoshaphat marries into that family, or by his son marries into that family. So that's something of a foreshadowing of what's to come, but also an emphasis on the degradation that was taking place in the northern kingdom. You can see the writer of Kings sort of amazement at this. He thought it was a trivial thing to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which was, of course, to set up these other places of worship, right, in the northern kingdom. But at least officially, they were to worship the true God. He said, well, that's not abandoning God enough. We got to really abandon God, say, in effect, and serve the Baals. There's a reference to the wooden image again. So that's part of the background that will come in more clearly later in Chronicles. And part of the reason that Jehoshaphat's sin is such a serious thing when we come to it is intermarriage, and how seriously, as we'll see later on, it affects even the preservation of the line of David. I want to make one other comment, which is just to emphasize that the writers of both of Kings and Chronicles have their own point of view, and they don't emphasize the things that a secular historian might emphasize. The father of Ahab here is given as Omri. You can look up in the verses that precede the passage I read about Omri. There's not much said about him. Right? Omri was the king of the northern kingdom. He was very famous in the realms around, so much so that 150 years after his rule, the Assyrians still referred to the northern kingdom as the dynasty of Omri. Omri was a big shot. He was probably the most powerful and effective, in a political sense, a ruler of the northern kingdom. But God's point of view on him is that he's not worth much in terms of discussion. There's little of significance about him, except that he fathered this very wicked man, Ahab, who was not an effective ruler in the same way Omri was. Well, that's just a bit of background of what's going on in the northern kingdom. Any comments or questions about that? We are quiet this morning. Okay. Well, let's go back to to 2 Chronicles 17 then. The emphasis, as I said, on the blessing of Jehoshaphat and his faithfulness comes out in emphasizing the military aspects, and that's already put forth in verse 2 in the placing of troops in the fortified cities of Judah. He had a reason. If guys like Omri and Ahab are around, you need to set up fortifications because they're not peaceful. peoples. Really, Omri wasn't. But there's a further development of that given in the blessing in terms of verse 5. The Lord established the kingdom in his hand, which is a strong statement of God's blessing. And all Judah gave presents to Jehoshaphat, and he had riches and honor in abundance. But the language here and later on in the chapter starts to sound like Solomon's glory. Right? You see the riches and honor and abundance, Judah bringing him presents, and skipping down a bit till after the part about the teaching. It says in verse 10, the fear of the Lord fell on all the kingdoms of the land that were around Judah, so they did not make war against Jehoshaphat. Some of the Philistines brought Jehoshaphat presents and silver as tribute, and the Arabians brought him flocks. And so it says in verse 12, so Jehoshaphat became increasingly powerful. He built fortresses and storage cities in Judah. But it may be hard for us to relate. You know, we don't normally think of ourselves as having people bring sheep to us and things like that. But this is obviously a signal honor that shows the great respect, and uses the stronger word here, the fear that fell on the kingdoms around him because of the honor that God had given to him. And he received great tribute even from the Philistines, which considering what a thorn in the flesh they've been, it's been amazing. Yeah, right. Yeah, just... That's a very good point. That's an excellent point. Yeah. Yeah, so Asa's father had received, actually had won spoil of battle before, and then turned around and passed it on to the Syrians, took the money out of the temple and sent it on. That's a very good point. Here his son is receiving the cash flow in, but in crude terms, the kingdoms around are not, he's not seeking to them for favor and alliance, not at this point, but instead they're terrified. They're giving him tribute. That's right. So the obvious fact is that wealth and honor from God comes from this. It's good to bring it out. Yeah, it's good. Any other comments? Yeah.
I love this idea of fortifying the cities and just sort of struck me as the mean by which God allows us to protect ourselves. It is allowed to protect themselves from the hostile nations around them. And oftentimes, it becomes a trap in that we begin to trust in the very thing that, that through God's blessing. So, the goodness of God becomes a temptation to and trust in God.
Yeah, that's a good point. That may be what goes on in Jehoshaphat's life. I don't think it's said explicitly, but that is the temptation is to trust in the means that God has provided, to look to them and not to look to God. Any other comments? Well, I'd like, as I said, to spend some time discussing the section here in verses 7, 8, and 9. There's a description of his sending out, the New King James calls them leaders, I think some of the other translations may call them officials, to teach in the cities of Judah. And then it says explicitly, with them went Levites, and their actions are described in verse, and also priests at the end of verse 8. And in verse 9 it says what they do. They taught in Judah and had the book of the law of the Lord with them. They went throughout all the cities of Judah and taught the people. Now, this action of Jehoshaphat is not something that he came up with on his own. As we've seen again and again, when faithful kings acted, when they told the priests to do something or brought about reforms, they were not acting on their own initiative. They were simply calling the people to do what that was God's command already. And that's what I thought I would spend some time discussing, because I think it's an interesting fact that this teaching ministry of the priests and Levites was in some ways the most prominent aspect of their ministry. In some ways you might say that's what they were there to do, to teach. And it took Jehoshaphat's working, apparently, of restoring that practice for this to take place in his day. Now, that's what I'd like to talk about, but let me just make one comment before we go further. It may sound like there's some sort of a mixing here of the civil rulers with the priestly rulers, as if somehow the civil ruler is going around telling people, you know, what the Levites and the priests should do. And I think that's clarified a bit if you turn over to chapter 19. The reference is somewhere in the middle here. Chapter 19, verses 4 through 12. As I mentioned before, this teaching ministry of Jehoshaphat is mentioned again. It's not really his ministry, but the restoration under his rule is mentioned again in chapter 19, especially in the context of ruling, that is, of judging. And you should realize you can't really separate the two, the informing of God's law as well as the sitting in judgment in cases of discipline or whatever the cases are, shouldn't be separated. Well, let me just point out, though, in 2 Chronicles 19, beginning at verse 4, Jehoshaphat, again, it says in verse 5, set judges in the land throughout all the fortified cities of Judah, city by city. There's, again, a description of what's going on, with an emphasis more here on the judgment aspect. But notice verse 11, at the end of the chapter there. And take notice, he says, Amariah the chief priest is over you in all matters of the Lord, and Zebediah, the son of Ishmael, the ruler of the house of Judah, for all the king's matters. See, there's that distinction between the matters of the Lord over which the chief priest has authority. So that would have to do especially with what we might call ecclesiastical discipline, versus the matters of the king over which this official rules, which would presumably be civil cases. And that distinction, I mean, you may say I'm sort of plucking it out of the thin air here, but that sort of distinction comes up elsewhere. And I mentioned one other reference in the Book of Chronicles, and that could be verified elsewhere in the setting up of things. I discussed this, I think, at the very beginning, that there was a separation of church and state in the sense that the civil magistrate had a distinct role from the office of leadership in the church. And that's reflected in the language in 2 Chronicles 19. This guy is over you in the matters of the Lord, and this guy is over you in the matters of the king. We'll come back to that, I promise, when we get to chapter 19. Maybe we can just talk about it some more. But I wanted to point out that what's going on in chapter 17 isn't some sort of a blurring of the lines there. Although there are officials mentioned and Levites and priests mentioned, there was still at least a separation in terms of authority of judgment. It's not clear what the role of the officials are here. They could they could just be acting as bodyguards for these guys who are going around teaching to having their own role in terms of teaching civil statutes. The law that was given covered both, and so it's not completely clear what's going on in chapter 17. But having made that distinction, I'd like to develop a little bit this claim I made that the teaching ministry of the Levites and of the priests, but especially the Levites, was in some ways the central role they had to carry out. I don't know about you, but you know, if someone asked me what did the Levites do, I'd say, well, they carried around the furniture in the desert, right? I mean, that was their job. They had to move from this place to that place. Who was going to carry all the stuff? Well, the Levites were supposed to do that. As we saw, when they actually came into a settled place, when the tabernacle was moved to Zion and later the temple was built, David, by inspiration of the Spirit, then appointed them to other roles, like to singing and preparing the music for song, the prophetic ministry of composing the songs they would use in worship. So there were other roles given to them, but the role that continues throughout the Old Testament is the role of teaching. And as I said, this I think hadn't I knew sort of that they did some of it, but I hadn't really looked into how much was about it. So of course you get carried away. So I put up here references. I counted references in 24 different chapters of the Old Testament, which talk about this teaching role that they carry out. It's a very significant thing, and I'd like to look at a few of them. I'm not saying these are all the references. There are only 24 different chapters in which this occurs. But I was kind of overwhelmed by the amount of information. So let's look at some of these references and start by turning to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 33 and verse 10. Let's go back even further. Let's go back to Leviticus chapter 10 first, the first reference I have up there. It's interesting that even at the founding, you might say, of the priestly role, that this sort of charge is given. And that in Leviticus chapter 10, I had down specifically verse 11. That's in the context of a charge to Aaron. You'll notice in verse 8, Aaron was not to be intoxicated while on duty, although the warning could be stronger than that. Certainly he was supposed to be sober. And it says in verse 10, the reason that you may distinguish between holy and unholy, between clean, unclean and clean, and that you may teach the children of Israel all the statutes which the Lord has spoken to them by the hand of Moses. And that twofold emphasis that this teaching and judging role of the priests and the Levites that we'll be seeing is represented here in verses 10 and 11. Verse 10, this distinguishing between holy and unholy, I think not only refers to teaching, but to the fact that they would have to give judgment, they would have to give rulings, I mean, even in cases of leprosy, whether the person was free from leprosy or not. And so that sort of judging role, which was broader, obviously, than just cases of leprosy, is one thing that's mentioned here. But also in verse 11, there's the mention of the fact that they are supposed to teach the children of Israel all the statutes which the Lord has spoken. And so that charge, even at the beginning of the ministry, is, as I said, repeated. And I'd like to look at a few references. If you have comments or questions, you can jump in, but not hearing any. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 33, verse 10. See, I'm skipping over a lot of references in Deuteronomy, so you can breathe more easily. We won't be here for 2 hours looking at all these verses. There are lots of references, though. In fact, except for references in Chronicles, which is about the same length, the book of Deuteronomy probably has as much information as you probably would expect it to have, because it talks about the foundation of the kingdom of Israel. In Deuteronomy 33, this is the blessing which God gives. And through Moses, and he blesses the tribes. And it's one of these, this is an important part of the Old Testament literature, these oracles of destiny, as they're sometimes called. And here Moses is setting out some characteristic features of each of the tribes and prays a blessing on them. And of Levi, the mention of Levi starts in verse 8 and has a reference first to this Thummim and Urim, which is a means by which they discern the will of God in the Old Testament, and talks about his faithfulness in executing the judgment of God when the people went astray at a couple of points in the wilderness, just one point. But let me focus especially on verse 10. They shall teach Jacob your judgments and Israel your law. They shall put incense before you and a whole burnt sacrifice on your altar. So there, even before the mention of the offering of sacrifices, which would have been the priestly role particularly, is the mention of the fact that their job is to teach Jacob the judgments of God and Israel the law of God. Now, they weren't faithful in doing that. That's not news to you, I suppose, but they didn't do it faithfully, even though that was their job. When the king, for example, in Deuteronomy 17 earlier, is supposed to copy out of a copy of the law for himself, it's supposed to be the copy that he gets from the priests and Levites. So they were equipped to do it. They had the book of the law, but they weren't faithful in following through with that. And as we've already noted in Chronicles, this was the thing that the faithful king sought to restore. We already saw in chapter 15 under Asa the reference to the people being without a teaching priest. And Jehoshaphat's restoration in chapter 17 is followed by other faithful rulers. I'd like to look at one other example in Chronicles. Let's turn to chapter 31, verse 4. This is near the end of Chronicles, in the sense that it's the reign of Hezekiah. Chronicler has a lot to say about Hezekiah, but it's near the end in terms of his development. Is this thing working? You can't actually see the wheels moving, I'm not sure. Second Chronicles chapter 31, the verse I had in mind in particular was verse 4. Hezekiah, of course, was a very thoroughgoing reformer and sought to restore, according to God's commandment, much of went on, the worship and the responsibilities of the different officials. And it says in verse 4, "Moreover, he commanded the people who dwelt in Jerusalem to contribute support for the priests and the Levites, that they might devote themselves to the law of the Lord." In other words, the part of the reason why the priests and the Levites didn't have full-time employment, you might say, in other areas, was so that they could devote themselves to the study of the law of the Lord. Right? It makes sense if you're going to go around teaching it, then you'd better know it. And Hezekiah encouraged the people to give what they were commanded in the law to give, to support the priests and Levites. And the purpose was that they could study the law of the Lord. Now, if this is starting to sound familiar, like this is what the New Testament model for supporting the men who work in the ministry full-time, then, well, that's sort of the direction I'm going. But you can see even here there's the commandment to call to faithfulness, that they would fulfill the duty that they had been given. Okay, so I will let's look just briefly at a couple of other passages before we reflect on the significance of this. Turn to the book of Nehemiah, Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, chapter 8. The references in Ezra to Ezra's work in teaching. You remember, after the return from exile, one of the great needs of the people was to know God's law. And the chronicler would have been written probably to those people who had the need for instruction. And that's why I think the chronicler would have especially wanted to relate this teaching role. But in Ezra and Nehemiah, there's a description of the revival of that in the time of the restoration after the exile. And in Deuteronomy chapter, in Nehemiah chapter 8, there's a description that actually goes on even into chapter 9 of how this took place. All the people gathered together as one man in the open square that was in front of the water gate, and they told Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded Israel. So Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly of men and women and all who could hear with understanding on the first day of the seventh month. Then he read from it in the open square that was in front of the water gate from morning until midday. Now there's a scripture reading for you. Before the men and women and those who could understand. And the ears of all the people were attentive to the book of the law. And then there are other men mentioned. Presumably one would get tired after reading so long. So I don't know exactly the function of these assistants, but one might think that they helped him in the reading, verse 4. And no, I'm not going to read all those names. I already read enough names in 2 Chronicles 17. But notice the reaction of the people in verse 6 is a heartfelt response. But notice in verse 7, these men are mentioned, Jeshua, Bani, and so forth. It says in verse 7, "They helped the people to understand the law, and the people stood in their place. So they read distinctly from the book in the law of God, and they gave the sense and helped them to understand the reading." So there is a mention in the law, and I skipped over the reference, of the periodic assembly of all the people together for the reading of the law. And this may be that, or it may be the regular, this may represent a regular ministry which took place. But in any case, it wasn't simply a formal reading. It's not like, you know, the book of the law is some magic book, you just read the words and everyone says, oh, it sounds great to me. Right? They explained it. They gave the sense of it. And that's part of the teaching ministry. But the emphasis here is, as in Chronicles, the chapter we read in 2 Chronicles 17, it's not just teaching anything, it's teaching the book of the law. It's teaching the law that God gave. As I said, I'll content myself with one other reference, but you should be encouraged to read. I'll encourage you to read through Nehemiah 8 and even the beginning of chapter 9 to see some of the details of the reading and the response of the people. It's a very powerful example of God using His Word by His Spirit to convict people and give repentance and life. One other reference that I'd like to look at is at the end of the Old Testament, in the book of Malachi. Last book of the Old Testament. Business of the responsibility of the priests and the Levites to teach may have been mentioned more often in the Old Testament in terms of the breach of the duty as opposed to their actually doing the duty. Certainly in the Minor Prophets,